Chapter 5. A Brief Treatise on the Moral Grounds of Economic Relations. To tell the history of debt, then, is also necessarily to reconstruct how the language of the marketplace has come to pervade every aspect of human life, even to provide the terminology for the moral and religious voices ostensibly raised against it. We've already seen how both Vedic and Christian teachings thus end up making the same curious move, first describing all morality as debt, but then, in their very manner of doing so, demonstrating that morality cannot be reduced to debt, that it must be grounded in something else. But what? Religious traditions prefer vast cosmological answers. The alternative to the morality of debt lies in the recognition of continuity with the universe, or life in the expectation of the imminent annihilation of the universe, or absolute subordination to the deity, or withdrawal into another world. My own aims are more modest, so I'll take the opposite approach. If we really want to understand the moral grounds of economic life, and by extension human life, it seems to me we must start instead with the very small things, the everyday details of social existence, the way we treat our friends, enemies, and children, often with gestures so tiny, passing the salt, bumming a cigarette, that we ordinarily never stop to think about them at all. Anthropology has shown us just how different and numerous are the ways in which humans have been known to organize themselves. But it also reveals some remarkable commonalities, fundamental moral principles that appear to exist everywhere, and that will always tend to be invoked whenever people transfer objects back and forth or argue about what other people owe them. One of the reasons that human life is so complicated in turn is because many of these principles contradict one another. As we'll see, they're constantly pulling us in radically different directions. The moral logic of exchange, and hence of debt, is only one. In any given situation, there are likely to be completely different moral principles that could be brought to bear. In this sense, the moral confusion discussed in the first chapter is hardly new. In a sense, moral thought is founded on this very tension. To really understand what debt is, then, it'll be necessary to understand how it's different from other sorts of obligation that human beings might have to one another, which in turn means mapping out what those other sorts of obligation actually are. Doing so, however, poses peculiar challenges. Contemporary social theory, economic anthropology included, offers surprisingly little help in this regard. There's an enormous anthropological literature on gifts, for instance, starting with the French anthropologist Marcel Mauss's essay of 1925, even on gift economies that operate on completely different principles than market economies, but in the end, almost all this literature concentrates on the exchange of gifts, assuming that whenever one gives a gift, this act incurs a debt, and the recipient must eventually reciprocate in kind. Much as in the case of the great religions, the logic of the marketplace has insinuated itself even into the thinking of those who are most explicitly opposed to it. As a result, I'm going to have to start over here to create a new theory pretty much from scratch. Part of the problem is the extraordinary place that economics currently holds in the social sciences. In many ways, it's treated as a kind of master discipline. Just about anyone who runs anything important in America is expected to have some training in economic theory, or at least to be familiar with its basic tenets. As a result, those tenets have come to be treated as received wisdom, as basically beyond question. One knows one's in the presence of received wisdom when, if one challenges it, the first reaction is to treat one as simply ignorant. You've obviously never heard of the Laffer curve. Clearly, you need a course in Economics 101. The theory is seen as so obviously true that no one who understands it could possibly disagree. What's more, those branches of social theory that make the greatest claims to scientific status, rational choice theory, for example, start from the same assumptions about human psychology that economists do. Human beings are best viewed as self-interested actors, calculating how to get the best terms possible out of any situation, the most profit or pleasure or happiness for the least sacrifice or investment. Curious, considering experimental psychologists have demonstrated over and over again that those assumptions simply aren't true. From early on, there were those who wished to create a theory of social interaction grounded in a more generous view of human nature, insisting that moral life comes down to something more than mutual advantage, that it's motivated above all by a sense of justice. The key term here became reciprocity, the sense of equity, balance, fairness, and symmetry embodied in our image of justice as a set of scales. Economic transactions were just one variant of the principle of balanced exchange, and one that had a notorious tendency to go awry. But if one examines matters closely, one finds that all human relations are based on the same variation of reciprocity. In the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, there was something of a craze for this sort of thing. In the guise of what was then called exchange theory, developed in infinite variations, from George Homan's social exchange theory in the United States to Claude Lévi-Strauss's structuralism in France. Lévi-Strauss, who became a kind of intellectual god in anthropology, made the extraordinary argument that human life could be imagined as consisting of three spheres: language, which consisted of the exchange of words; kinship, which consisted of the exchange of women; and economics, which consisted of the exchange of things. All three, he insisted, were governed by the same fundamental law of reciprocity. Lévi-Strauss's star has fallen now, and such extreme statements seem, in retrospect, a little bit ridiculous. Still, it's not as if anyone has proposed a bold new theory to replace all this. Instead, the assumptions have simply retreated into the background. Almost everyone continues to assume that in its fundamental nature, social life is based on the principle of reciprocity, and therefore that all human interaction can best be understood as a kind of exchange. If so, then debt really is at the root of all morality, because debt is what happens when some balance has not yet been restored. But can all justice really be reduced to reciprocity? It's easier to come up with forms of reciprocity that don't seem particularly just. Do unto others as you wish others to do unto you might seem like an excellent foundation for a system of ethics. But for most of us, an eye for an eye does not evoke justice so much as vindictive brutality. One good turn deserves another is a pleasant sentiment, but I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine, is shorthand for political corruption. Conversely, there are relations that seem clearly moral, but appear to have nothing to do with reciprocity. The relation between mother and child is an oft-cited example. Most of us learn our sense of justice and morality first from our parents. Yet it's extremely difficult to see the relationship between parent and child as particularly reciprocal. Would we really be willing to concede that therefore it is not a moral relationship, that it has nothing to do with justice? The Canadian novelist Margaret Atwood begins a recent book on debt with a similar paradox. Quote, nature writer Ernest Thompson Seton had an odd bill presented to him on his 21st birthday. It was a record kept by his father of all the expenses connected with young Ernest's childhood and youth, including the fee charged by the doctor for delivering him. Even more oddly, Ernest is said to have paid it. I used to think Mr. Seton Sr. was a jerk, but now I'm wondering. Unquote. Most of us wouldn't wonder much. Such behaviour seems monstrous, inhuman. Certainly Seton thought so. He paid the bill, but never spoke to his father again afterward. And in a way, this is precisely why the presentation of such a bill seems so outrageous. Squaring accounts means that the two parties have the ability to walk away from each other. By presenting it, his father suggested that he'd just as soon have nothing further to do with him. In other words, while most of us can imagine what we owe to our parents as a kind of debt, few of us can imagine being able to actually pay it, or even that such a debt should be paid. Yet, if it can't be paid, in what sense is it a debt at all? And if it's not a debt, what is it? One obvious place to look for alternatives is in cases of human interaction in which expectations of reciprocity seem to slam into a wall. 19th-century travellers' accounts, for instance, are full of this sort of thing. Missionaries working in certain parts of Africa would be astounded by the reactions they would receive when they administered medicines. Here's a typical example from a British missionary in Congo. Quote, a day or two after we reached Varna, we found one of the natives very ill with pneumonia. Komba treated him and kept him alive on strong fowl soup. A great deal of nursing and attention was visited on him, for his house was beside the camp. When we were ready to go on our way again, the man was well. To our astonishment, he came and asked us for a present, and was astonished and disgusted, as he had made us to be, when we declined in giving it. We suggested that perhaps it was his place to bring us a present and to show some gratitude. He said to us, "Well, indeed, you white men have no sense of shame." Unquote. In the early decades of the 20th century, the French philosopher Lucien Levi-Brulle, in an attempt to prove that natives operated with an entirely different form of logic, compiled a list of similar stories, for instance, of a man saved from drowning who proceeded to ask his rescuer to give him some nice clothes to wear, or another who, on being nursed back to health after having been savaged by a tiger, demanded a knife. One French missionary, working in Central Africa, insisted that such things happened to him on a regular basis. Quote, "You save a person's life, you must expect to receive a visit from him before long. You are now under an obligation to him, and you will not get rid of him except by giving him presents." Unquote. Now, certainly, there is almost always felt to be something extraordinary about saving a life. Anything surrounding birth and death almost cannot help but partake of the infinite, and therefore throw all everyday means of moral calculation askew. This is probably why stories like this became something of a cliché in America when I was growing up. I remember as a child several times being told that the Inuit, or sometimes it was the Buddhists or the Chinese, but curiously never Africans, that if one saves someone's life, one is considered responsible for taking care of that person forever. It defies our sense of reciprocity. Somehow, it also makes a weird kind of sense. We have no way of knowing what was really going on in the minds of the patients in these stories, since we don't know who they were or what sort of expectations they had, how they normally interacted with doctors, for example. But we can guess. Let's try a thought experiment. Imagine we're dealing with a place where, if one man saved another's life, the two became like brothers. Each was now expected to share everything and to provide for the other when he was in need. If so, the patient would surely notice that his new brother appeared to be extraordinarily wealthy, not in need of anything much, but that he, the patient, was lacking in many things the missionary could provide. Alternately, and more likely, imagine we're dealing not with a relationship of radical equality, but with the very opposite. In many parts of Africa, accomplished curers were also important political figures with extensive clienteles of former patients. A would-be follower thus arrives to declare his political allegiance. What complicates the matter, in this case, is that followers of great men in this part of Africa were in a relatively strong bargaining position. Good henchmen were hard to come by. Important people were expected to be generous with followers to keep them from joining some rival's entourage instead. If so, asking for a shirt or a knife would be a way of asking for confirmation that the missionary does wish to have the man as a follower. Paying him back, in contrast, would be, like Seton's gesture to his father, an insult, a way of saying that despite the missionary having saved his life, he would just as soon have nothing further to do with him. This is a thought experiment, because we don't really know what the African patients were thinking. The point is that such forms of radical equality and radical inequality do exist in the world, that each carries its own kind of morality with it, its own way of thinking and arguing about the rights and wrongs of any given situation. And these moralities are entirely different from that of the tit-for-tat exchange. In the rest of the chapter, I'll provide a rough-and-ready way to map out the main possibilities by proposing that there are three main moral principles on which economic relations can be founded, all of which occur in any human society, and which I will call communism, hierarchy, and exchange. Communism. I will define communism here as any human relationship that operates on the principles of from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. I admit that the usage here is a bit provocative. Communism is a word that can evoke strong emotional reactions, mainly, of course, because we tend to identify it with the communist regimes. This is ironic, since the communist parties that ruled the USSR and its satellites, and that still rule China and Cuba, never described their own systems as communist. They described them as socialist. Communism was always a distant, somewhat fuzzy, utopian ideal, usually to be accompanied by the withering away of the state, to be achieved at some point in the distant future. Our thinking about communism has been dominated by a myth. Once upon a time, humans held all things in common. In the Garden of Eden, during the golden age of Saturn, in Paleolithic hunter-gatherer bands. Then came the fall, as a result of which we are now cursed with divisions of power and private property. The dream was that some day, with the advance of technology and general prosperity, with social revolution or the guidance of the party, we would finally be in a position to put things back, to restore common ownership and common management of collective resources. Throughout the last two centuries, communists and anti-communists have argued over how plausible this picture was, and whether it would be a blessing or a nightmare. But they all agreed on the basic framework. Communism was about collective property. Primitive communism did once exist in the distant past, and someday it might return. We might call this mythic communism, or even epic communism. A story we like to tell ourselves. Since the days of the French Revolution, it's inspired millions. But it's also done enormous damage to humanity. It's high time, I think, to brush the entire argument aside. In fact, communism is not some kind of magical utopia, neither does it have anything to do with the ownership of the means of production. It is something that exists right now, that exists to some degree in any human society, although there has never been one in which everything has been organized in that way, and it would be difficult to imagine how there could be. All of us act like communists a good deal of the time. None of us acts like a communist consistently. Communist society, in the sense of a society organized exclusively on that single principle, could never exist. But all social systems, even economic systems like capitalism, have always been built on top of a bedrock of actually existing communism. Starting, as I say, from the principle of from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs, allows us to look past the question of individual or private ownership, which is often little more than a formal legality anyway, and at much more immediate and practical questions of who has access to what sorts of things and under what conditions. Whenever it is the operative principle, even if it's just two people who are interacting, we can say we're in the presence of a sort of communism. Almost everyone follows this principle if they're collaborating on some common project. If someone fixing a broken water pipe says, "Hand me the wrench," his co-worker will not generally say, "And what do I get for it?" even if they're working for ExxonMobil, Burger King, or Goldman Sachs. The reason is simple efficiency. Ironically enough, considering the conventional wisdom that communism just doesn't work, if you really care about getting something done, the most efficient way to go about it is obviously to allocate tasks by ability, give people whatever they need to do them. One might even say that it's one of the scandals of capitalism that most capitalist firms internally operate communistically. True, they don't tend to operate very democratically. Most often, they're organized around military-style, top-down chains of command. But there is an interesting tension here, because top-down chains of command are not particularly efficient. They tend to promote stupidity among those on the top, resentful foot-dragging among those on the bottom. The greater the need to improvise, the more democratic the cooperation tends to become. Inventors have always understood this. Startup capitalists frequently figure it out. And computer engineers have recently rediscovered the principle, not only with things like freeware, which everyone talks about, but even in the organization of their businesses. Apple Computers is a famous example. It was founded by mostly Republican computer engineers who broke from IBM in Silicon Valley in the 1980s, forming little democratic circles of 20 to 40 people with their laptops in each other's garages. This is presumably why, in the immediate wake of great disasters, a flood, a blackout, or an economic collapse, people tend to behave in the same way, reverting to a rough-and-ready communism. However briefly, hierarchies and markets and the like become luxuries that no one can afford. Anyone who's lived through such a moment can speak to their peculiar qualities, The way that strangers become sisters and brothers, and human society itself seems to be reborn. This is important because it shows that we're not talking simply about cooperation. In fact, communism is the foundation of all human sociability. It's what makes society possible. There is always an assumption that anyone who is not actually an enemy can be expected to help, on the principle of from each according to their abilities, at least to an extent. For example, if one needs to figure out how to get somewhere, and the other person knows the way. We take this for granted, in fact, and the exceptions are themselves revealing. E.E. Evans Pritchard, an anthropologist who in the 1920s carried out some research amongst the Nuer Nilotic pastoralists in southern Sudan, reports his discomfiture when he realized someone had intentionally given him wrong directions. Quote, "On one occasion, I asked the way to a certain place and was deliberately deceived. I returned in chagrin to camp and asked the people why they had told me the wrong way. One of them replied, 'You are a foreigner. Why should we tell you the right way? Even if a Nuer, who was a stranger, asked us the way, we would say to him, "You continue straight forward along that path," but we would not tell him the path is forked. Why should we tell him? But you are now a member of our camp, and you are kind to our children, so we will tell you the right way in future." Unquote. The Nuer are constantly engaged in feuds. Any stranger might well turn out to be an enemy, there to scout out for a good place for an ambush, and it would be unwise to give a person such useful information. What's more, Evan Pritchard's own situation was obviously relevant, since he was an agent of the British government, and the same government that had recently sent in the RAF to strafe and bomb the inhabitants of this very settlement before forcibly resettling them there. Under the circumstances, the inhabitants' treatment of Evans Pritchard seems quite generous. The main point, though, is that it requires something on this scale, an immediate threat to life and limb, terror bombing of civilian populations, before people will ordinarily consider not giving a stranger accurate directions. It's not just directions. Conversation is a domain particularly disposed to communism. Lies, insults, put-downs, and other sorts of verbal aggression are important, but they derive most of their power from the shared assumption that people do not ordinarily act this way. An insult does not sting unless one assumes that others will normally be considerate of one's feelings. It's impossible to lie to someone who does not assume you would ordinarily tell the truth. When we genuinely wish to break off amicable relations with someone, we stop speaking with them entirely. The same goes for small courtesies like asking for a light, or even for a cigarette. It seems more legitimate to ask a stranger for a cigarette than for an equivalent amount of cash, or even food. In fact, if one has been identified as a fellow smoker, it's rather difficult to refuse such a request. In such cases, a match, a piece of information, holding the elevator, one might say that from each element is so minimal that most of us comply without even thinking about it. Conversely, the same is true if another person's need, even a stranger's, is particularly spectacular or extreme. If he's drowning, for example, if a child has fallen onto the subway tracks, we assume that anyone who is capable of helping her up will do so. I call this baseline communism, the understanding that, unless people consider themselves enemies, if the need is considered great enough, or the cost considered reasonable enough, the principle of from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs, will be assumed to apply. Of course, different communities apply very different standards. In large, impersonal, urban communities, such a standard may go no further than asking for a light or directions. This might not seem like much, but it founds the possibility of larger social relations. In smaller, less impersonal communities, especially those not divided into social classes, the same logic will likely extend much further. For example, it's often effectively impossible to refuse a request not just for tobacco, but for food, sometimes even from a stranger. Certainly from anyone considered to belong to the community. Exactly one page after describing his difficulties in asking for directions, Evans Pritchard notes that the same Nuer find it almost impossible, when dealing with someone they've accepted as a member of their camp, to refuse a request for almost any item of common consumption, so that a man or woman known to have anything extra in the way of grain, tobacco, tools, or agricultural implements can be expected to see their stockpiles disappear almost immediately. However, this baseline of open-handed sharing and generosity never extends to everything. Often, in fact, things freely shared are treated as trivial and unimportant for that very reason. Among the Nuer, true wealth takes the form of cattle. No one would freely share their cattle. In fact, young Nuer men learn that they are expected to defend their cattle with their lives. For this reason, cattle are neither bought nor sold. The obligation to share food and whatever else is considered a basic necessity tends to become the basis of everyday morality in a society whose members see themselves as equals. Another anthropologist, Audrey Richards, once described how Bemba mothers, such lax disciplinarians in everything else, will scold their children harshly if they give one an orange or some other treat and the child does not immediately offer to share it with their friends. But sharing is also, in such societies, in any if we really think about it, a major focus of life's pleasures. As a result, the need to share is particularly acute in both the best of times and the worst of times. During famines, for example, but also during moments of extreme plenty. Early missionary accounts of native North Americans almost invariably include awe-struck remarks on generosity in times of famine, often to total strangers. At the same time, quote, on returning from their fishing, their hunting, and their trading, they exchange many gifts. If they have thus obtained something unusually good, even if they've bought it, or if it's been given to them, they make a feast to the whole village with it. Their hospitality towards all sorts of strangers is remarkable. Unquote. The more elaborate the feast, the more likely one is to see some combination of free sharing of some things, for instance food and drink, and careful distribution of others, say prize meat, whether from game or sacrifice, which is often parcelled out according to very elaborate protocols, or equally elaborate gift exchange. The giving and taking of gifts often takes on a distinctly game-like quality, continuous often with actual games, contests, pageants, and performances, that also often mark popular festivals, as with society at large. The shared conviviality could be seen as a kind of communistic base, on top of which everything else is constructed. It also helps to emphasize that sharing is not simply about morality, but also about pleasure. Solitary pleasures will always exist, but for most human beings, the most pleasurable activities always involve sharing something: music, food, liquor, drugs, gossip, drama, beds. There is a certain communism of the senses at the root of most things we consider fun. The surest way to know that one is in the presence of communistic relations is that not only are no accounts taken, but it would be considered offensive or simply bizarre to even consider doing so. Each village, clan, or nation within the League of the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois, for example, was divided into two halves. This is a common pattern. In other parts of the world, Amazonia, Melanesia, too, there are arrangements in which members of one side can only marry someone from the other side, or only eat food grown on the other side. Such rules are explicitly designed to make each side dependent on the other for some basic necessity of life. Among the six Iroquois, each side was expected to bury the others dead. Nothing would be more absurd than for one side to complain that, last year, we buried five of your dead, but you only buried two of ours. Baseline communism might be considered the raw material of sociality, a recognition of our ultimate interdependence that is the ultimate substance of social peace. Still, in most circumstances, that minimal baseline is not enough. One always behaves in a spirit of solidarity more with some people than others, and certain institutions are specifically based on principles of solidarity and mutual aid. First among these are those we love, with mothers being the paradigm of selfless love. Others include close relatives, wives and husbands, lovers, one's closest friends. These are the people with whom we share everything. or at least to whom we know we can turn in need, which is the definition of a true friend everywhere. Such friendships may be formalized by ritual as bond friends or blood brothers who cannot refuse each other anything. As a result, any community could be seen as crisscrossed with relations of individualistic communism, one-to-one relations that operate, to varying intensities and degrees, on the basis of, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. This same logic can be, and is, extended within groups. Not only cooperative work groups, but almost any in-group will define itself by creating its own sort of baseline communism. There'll be certain things shared or made freely available within the group, others that anyone will be expected to provide for other members upon request, that one would never share with or provide to outsiders, help in repairing one's nets in an association of fishermen, stationery supplies in an office, certain sorts of information among commodity traders, and so forth. Also, certain categories of people we can always call on in certain situations, such as harvesting or moving house. One could go on from here to describe various forms of sharing, pooling, who gets to call on whom for help with certain tasks, moving or harvesting, or even, if one's in trouble, providing an interest-free loan. Finally, there are different sorts of commons, the collective administration of common resources. The sociology of everyday communism is a potentially enormous field, but one which, owing to our particular ideological blinkers, we've been unable to write about because we've been largely unable to see it. Rather than try to further outline it, I'll limit myself to three final points. First, we're not really dealing with reciprocity here, or at best, only with reciprocity in the broadest sense. What is equal on both sides is the knowledge that the other person would do the same for you, not that they necessarily will. The Iroquois example brings home clearly what makes this possible, that such relations are based on the presumption of eternity. Society will always exist. Therefore, there will always be a north and a south side of the village. This is why no accounts need be taken. In a similar way, people tend to treat their mothers and their best friends as if they will always exist, however well they know that this isn't true. The second point has to do with the famous law of hospitality. There's a peculiar tension between a common stereotype of what are called primitive societies, that is, people lacking both in states and markets, as societies in which anyone not a member of the community is assumed to be an enemy, and the frequent accounts of early European travellers awestruck by the extraordinary generosity shown to them by actual savages. Granted, there is a certain truth to both sides. Whenever a stranger is a dangerous potential enemy, the normal way to overcome that danger is by some dramatic gesture of generosity, whose very magnificence catapults them into that mutual sociality which is the ground for all peaceful social relations. True, when one is dealing with completely unknown quantities, there is often a process of testing. Both Christopher Columbus in Hispaniola and Captain Cook in Polynesia reported similar stories of islanders who either flee, attack, or offer everything, but who often later enter the boats and help themselves to anything they take a fancy to, provoking threats of violence from the crew, who then did their utmost to establish the principle that relations between strange peoples should be mediated instead by normal commercial exchange. It's understandable that dealings with potentially hostile strangers should encourage an all-or-nothing logic. Attention preserved, even in English, in the etymology of the words host, hostile, hostage, and indeed hospitality, all of which are derived from the same Latin root. What I want to emphasize here is that all such gestures are simply exaggerated displays of that very baseline communism that I've already argued is the ground of all human social life. This is why, for instance, the difference between friends and enemies is so often articulated through food, and often the most commonplace, humble, domestic sorts of food, as in the familiar principle, common in both Europe and the Middle East, that those who have shared bread and salt must never harm one another. In fact, those things that exist above all to be shared become the things one cannot share with enemies. Among the Nuer, so free with food and everyday possessions, one man murders another, a blood feud follows. Everyone in the vicinity will often have to line up on one side or another, and those on opposite sides are strictly forbidden to eat with anyone on the other, or even to drink from a cup or bowl one of their newfound enemies has previously used, lest terrible results ensue. The extraordinary inconvenience this creates is a major incentive to try to negotiate some sort of settlement. By the same token, it's often said that people who've shared food, or the right archetypal kind of food, are forbidden to harm one another, however much they might be otherwise inclined to do so. At times, this can take on an almost comical formality, as in the Arab story of a burglar who, while ransacking someone's house, stuck his finger in a jar to see if it was full of sugar, only to discover it was full of salt instead. Realizing that he'd now eaten salt at the owner's table, he dutifully put back everything he had stolen. Finally, once we start thinking of communism as a principle of morality rather than just a question of property ownership, it becomes clear that this sort of morality is almost always at play, to some degree, in any transaction, even commerce. If one is on sociable terms with someone, it's hard to completely ignore their situation. Merchants often reduce prices for the needy. This is one of the main reasons why shopkeepers in poor neighborhoods are almost never of the same ethnic group as their customers. It would be almost impossible for a merchant who grew up in the neighborhood to make money, as they would be under constant pressure to give financial breaks, or at least easy credit terms, to their impoverished relatives and school chums. The opposite is true as well. An anthropologist who lived for some time in rural Java once told me that she measured her linguistic abilities by how well she could bargain at the local bazaar. It frustrated her that she could never get it down to a price as low as local people seemed to pay. Well, a Javanese friend finally had to explain, they charge rich Javanese people more, too. Once again, we are back to the principle that if the needs, for instance dire poverty, or the abilities, for instance wealth beyond imagination, are sufficiently dramatic, then, unless there is a complete absence of sociality, some degree of communistic morality will almost inevitably enter into the way people take accounts. A Turkish folk tale about the medieval Sufi mystic Nasiruddin Hoxha illustrates the complexities thus introduced into the very concept of supply and demand. One day, when Nasiruddin was left in charge of the local tea house, the king and some retainers who'd been hunting nearby stopped in for breakfast. "Do you have quail eggs?" asked the king. "I'm sure I can find some," answered Nasiruddin. The king ordered an omelette of a dozen quail eggs, and Nasiruddin hurried out to look for them. After the king and his party had eaten, he charged them 100 gold pieces. The king was puzzled. "Are quail eggs really that rare in this part of the country?" "It's not so much that quail eggs are rare around here," Nasiruddin replied. "It's more visits from kings." Exchange. Communism, then, is based neither in exchange nor in reciprocity, except, as I've observed, in the sense that it does involve mutual expectations and responsibilities. Even here, it seems better to use another word, mutuality, maybe, so as to emphasize that exchange operates on entirely different principles, that it's a fundamentally different kind of moral logic. Exchange is all about equivalence. It's a back-and-forth process involving two sides, in which each side gives as good as it gets. This is why one can speak of people exchanging words, if there's an argument, blows, or even gunfire. In these examples, it's not that there is ever an exact equivalence, even if there were some way to measure an exact equivalence, but more a constant process of interaction tending towards equivalence. Actually, there's something of a paradox here. Each side in each case is trying to outdo the other. But, unless one side is utterly put to rout, it's easiest to break off the whole thing when both consider the outcome to be more or less even. When we move to the exchange of material goods, we find a similar tension. Often there is an element of competition. If nothing else, there's always that possibility. But, at the same time, there's a sense that both sides are keeping accounts, and that, unlike what happens in communism, which always partakes of a certain notion of eternity, the entire relation can be cancelled out, and either party can call an end to it at any time. This element of competition can work in completely different ways. In cases of barter or commercial exchange, when both parties to the transaction are only interested in the value of goods being transacted, they may well, as economists insist they should, try to seek the maximum material advantage. On the other hand, as anthropologists have long pointed out, when the exchanges of gifts, that is, of the objects passing back and forth, are mainly considered interesting in how they reflect on and rearrange relations between the people carrying out the transaction, then, insofar as competition enters in, it is likely to work precisely the other way around, to become a matter of contests of generosity, of people showing off who can give more away. Let me take these one at a time. What marks commercial exchange is that it's impersonal. Who it is that is selling something to us or buying something from us should in principle be entirely irrelevant. We are simply comparing the value of two objects. True, as with any principle, in practice this is rarely completely true. There has to be some minimal element of trust for a transaction to be carried out at all, and unless one is dealing with a vending machine, that usually requires some outward display of sociality. Even in the most impersonal shopping mall or supermarket, clerks are expected to at least simulate personal warmth, patience, or have other reassuring qualities. In a Middle Eastern bazaar, one might have to go through an elaborate process of establishing a simulated friendship, sharing tea, food, or tobacco, before engaging in a similarly elaborate haggling, an interesting ritual that begins by establishing sociality through baseline communism, and continues with an often prolonged mock battle over prices. It's all done on the basis of the assumption that buyer and seller are, at least for that moment, friends, and thus entitled to feel outraged and indignant at the other's unreasonable demands. But it's all a little piece of theatre. Once the object changes hands, there's no expectation that the two will ever have anything to do with each other again. Most often this sort of haggling, in Madagascar the term for it literally means to battle out a sale, Miadi Varotra, can be a source of pleasure in itself. The first time I visited Analekeli, the great cloth market in Madagascar's capital, I came with a Malagasy friend intent on buying a sweater. The whole process took about 4 hours. It went something like this. My friend would spot a likely sweater hanging in some booth, ask the price, and then she would begin a prolonged battle of wits with the vendor, invariably involving dramatic displays of insult and indignation, and simulated walkings off in disgust. Often it seems that 90% of the argument was spent on a final tiny difference of a few ariary, literally pennies, that seemed to become a profound matter of principle on either side, since a merchant's failure to concede it would sink the entire deal. The second time I visited Analekeli, I went with another friend, also a young woman, who had a list of measures of cloth to buy, supplied by her sister. At each booth, she adopted the same procedure. She simply walked up and asked for the price. The man would quote her one. "All right," she then asked, "and what's your real, final price?" He'd tell her, and she'd hand over the money. "Wait a minute," I asked. "You can do that?" "Sure," she said. "Why not?" I explained what happened with my last friend. "Oh, yeah," she said, "some people enjoy that sort of thing." Exchange allows us to cancel out our debts. It gives us a way to call it even, hence to end the relationship. With vendors, one is usually only pretending to have a relationship at all. With neighbors, one might for this very reason prefer not to pay one's debts. Laura Bohannon writes about arriving in a Tiv community in rural Nigeria. Neighbors immediately began arriving, bearing little gifts. 2 ears corn, 1 vegetable marrow, 1 chicken, 5 tomatoes, 1 handful peanuts. Having no idea what was expected of her, she thanked them and wrote down in a notebook their names and what they had brought. Eventually, 2 women adopted her and explained that all such gifts did have to be returned. It would be entirely inappropriate to simply accept 3 eggs from a neighbor and never bring anything back. One did not have to bring back eggs, but one should bring back something of approximately the same value. One could even bring money, there was nothing inappropriate in that, provided one did so at a discreet interval, and above all, that one did not bring the exact cost of the eggs. It had to be either a bit more or a bit less. To bring back nothing at all would be to cast oneself as an exploiter or a parasite. To bring back an exact equivalent would be to suggest that one no longer wishes to have anything to do with the neighbour. Tiv women, she learned, might spend a good part of the day walking for miles to distant homesteads to return a handful of okra or a tiny bit of change, in an endless circle of gifts to which no one ever handed over the precise value of the object last received, and, in doing so, they were continually creating their society. There was certainly a trace of communism here. Neighbours on good terms could also be trusted to help out in each other's emergencies. But, unlike communistic relations, which were assumed to be permanent, this sort of neighbourliness had to be constantly created and maintained, because any link can be broken off at any time. There are endless variations on this sort of tit-for-tat, or almost tit-for-tat, gift exchange. The most familiar is the exchange of presents. I buy someone a beer, they buy me the next one. Perfect equivalence implies equality. But consider a slightly more complicated example. I take a friend out at a fancy restaurant for dinner. After a discreet interval, they do the same. As anthropologists have long been in the habit of pointing out, the very existence of such customs, especially the feeling that one really ought to return the favour, can't be explained by standard economic theory, which assumes that any human interaction is ultimately a business deal and that we're all self-interested individuals trying to get the most for ourselves for the least cost or the least amount of effort. But this feeling I have is quite real, and it can cause a genuine strain for those of limited resources trying to keep up appearances. So why, if I took a free market economist theorist out to an expensive dinner, would that economist feel somewhat diminished, uncomfortably in my debt, until he'd been able to return the favour? Why, if he were feeling competitive with me, would he be inclined to take me someplace even more expensive? Recall the feasts and festivals alluded to above. Here, too, there is a base of conviviality and playful, sometimes not so playful, competition. On the other hand, everyone's pleasure is enhanced. After all, how many people would really want to eat a superb meal at a French restaurant all alone? On the other, things can easily slip into games of one-upmanship, and hence obsession, humiliation, rage, or, as we'll soon see, even worse. In some societies, these games are formalized, but it's important to stress that such games only really develop between people or groups who perceive themselves to be more or less equivalent in status. To return to our imaginary economist, it's not clear that he would feel diminished if he received a present or was taken out to dinner by just anyone. He would be most likely to feel this way if the benefactor were someone he felt was of roughly equivalent status or dignity, a colleague, for example. If Bill Gates or George Soros took him out to dinner, he would likely conclude that he'd indeed received something for nothing and leave it at that. If some ingratiating junior colleague or eager graduate student did the same, he'd be likely to conclude that he was doing the man a favour just by accepting the invitation, if he indeed did accept, which he probably wouldn't. This, too, appears to be the case wherever we find society divided into fine gradations of status and dignity. Pierre Bourdieu has described the dialectic of challenge and riposte that governs all games of honour among Kabylie Berber men in Algeria, in which the exchange of insults, attacks in feuds or battles, thefts or threats, were seen to follow exactly the same logic as the exchange of gifts. To give a gift is both an honour and a provocation. To respond to one requires infinite artistry. Timing is all important. So is making the counter-gift just slightly different enough, but also just slightly grander. Above all is the tacit moral principle that one must always pick on someone one's own size. To challenge someone obviously older, richer and more honourable is to risk being snubbed, and hence humiliated. To overwhelm a poor but respectable man with a gift he couldn't possibly pay back is simply cruel, and will do equal damage to your reputation. There's an Indonesian story about that too, about a rich man who sacrificed a magnificent ox to shame a penurious rival. The poor man utterly humiliated him and won the contest by calmly proceeding to sacrifice a chicken. Games like this become especially elaborate when status is to some degree up for grabs. When matters are too clear-cut, that introduces its own sort of problems. Giving gifts to kings is often a particularly tricky and complicated business. The problem here is that one cannot really give a gift fit for a king, unless perhaps one is another king, since kings by definition already have everything. On the other hand, one is expected to make a reasonable effort. Nasiruddin was once called up to visit the king. A neighbour saw him, hurrying along the road, carrying a bag of turnips. "What are those for?" he asked. "I've been called to see the king. I thought it would be best to bring some kind of present." "You're bringing him turnips? But turnips are peasant food. He's a king. You should bring him something more appropriate, like grapes." Nasiruddin agreed and came to the king carrying a bunch of grapes. The king was not amused. "You're giving me grapes? But I'm a king. This is ridiculous. Take this idiot out and teach him some manners. Throw each and every one of the grapes at him and then kick him out of the palace." The emperor's guards dragged Nasiruddin into a side room and began pelting him with the grapes. As they did so, he fell on his knees and began crying, thank you, God, for your infinite mercy." "Why are you thanking God?" they asked. "You're being totally humiliated." Nasiruddin replied, "Oh, I was just thinking, thank God I didn't bring the turnips." On the other hand, to give something that a king does not already have can get you into even greater trouble. One story circulating in the early Roman Empire concerned an inventor who, with great fanfare, presented a glass bowl as a gift to the Emperor Tiberius. The emperor was puzzled. What was so impressive about a piece of glass? The man dropped it on the ground. Rather than shattering, it merely dented. He picked it up and simply pushed it back into its former shape. "Did you tell anyone else how you made this thing?" asked a startled Tiberius. The inventor assured him that he had not. The emperor therefore ordered him killed, since, if word of how to make unbreakable glass got out, his treasury of gold and silver would soon be worthless. The best bet, when dealing with kings, was to make a reasonable effort to play the game, but one that is still bound to fail. The 14th century Arab traveller Ibn Battuta tells of the customs of the king of Sindh, a terrifying monarch who took a particular delight in displays of arbitrary power. It was customary for foreign worthies visiting the king to present him with magnificent presents. Whatever the gift was, he would invariably respond by presenting the bearer with something many times its value. As a result, substantial business developed where local bankers would lend money to such visitors to finance particularly spectacular gifts, knowing they would be well repaid from the proceeds of royal one-upmanship. The king must have known about this. He didn't object, since the whole point was to show that his wealth exceeded all possible equivalents, and if he really needed to, he could always expropriate the bankers. They knew that the really important game was not economic, but one of status, and his was absolute. In exchange, the gifts being traded are seen as equivalent. Therefore, by implication, so are the people, at least at the moment when the gift is met with counter-gift, or money changes hands. When there is no further debt or obligation, and each of these two parties is equally free to walk away. This, in turn, implies autonomy. Both principles sit uncomfortably with monarchs, which is the reason that kings generally dislike any sort of exchange. But, within that overhanging prospect of potential cancellation, of ultimate equivalence, we find endless variations, endless games one can play. One can demand something from another person, knowing that by doing so, one is giving the other the right to demand something of equivalent value in return. In some contexts, even praising another's possession might be interpreted as a demand of this sort. In 18th century New Zealand, English settlers soon learned that it was not a good idea to admire, say, a particularly beautiful jade pendant worn around the neck of a Maori warrior. The latter would invariably insist on giving it, not take no for an answer, and then, after a discreet interval, return to praise the settler's coat or gun. The only way to head this off was to quickly give him a gift, before he could ask for one. Sometimes gifts are offered in order for the giver to be able to make such a demand. If one accepts the present, one is tacitly agreeing to allow the giver to claim whatever he deems equivalent. All this, in turn, can shade into something very much like barter, directly swapping one thing for another, which, as we've seen, does occur even in what Marcel Mauss liked to refer to as gift economies, even if largely between strangers. Within communities, there is almost always a reluctance, as the TIV example so nicely illustrates, to allow things to cancel out. One reason that if there is money in common usage, people will often either refuse to use it with friends or relatives, which in a village society includes pretty much everyone, or alternatively, like the Malagasy villagers in Chapter 3, use it in radically different ways. Hierarchy. Exchange, then, implies formal equality, or at least the potential for it. This is precisely why kings have such trouble with it. In contrast, relations of explicit hierarchy, that is, relations between at least two parties in which one is considered superior to the other, do not tend to operate by reciprocity at all. It's hard to see, because the relation is often justified in reciprocal terms. The peasants provide food, the lords provide protection. But the principle by which they operate is exactly the opposite. In practice, hierarchy tends to work by a logic of precedent. To illustrate what I mean by this, let's imagine a kind of continuum of one-sided social relations, ranging from the most exploitative to the most benevolent. At one extreme is theft or plunder, on the other extreme, selfless charity. Only at these two extremes is it possible to have material interactions between people who otherwise have no social relation of any kind. Only a lunatic would mug his next-door neighbour. A band of marauding soldiers or nomadic horsemen falling on a peasant hamlet to rape and pillage also obviously have no intention of forming ongoing relations with the survivors. But, in a similar way, religious traditions often insist that the only true charity is anonymous. In other words, not meant to place the recipient in one's debt. One extreme form of this, documented in various parts of the world, is the gift by stealth, a kind of reverse burglary, to literally sneak into the recipient's house at night and plant one's present so no one can know for sure who's left it. The figure of Santa Claus, or Saint Nicholas, who, it must be remembered, was not just the patron saint of children, but also the patron saint of thieves, would appear to be the mythological version of the same principle. A benevolent burglar, with whom no social relations are possible, and therefore to whom no one could possibly owe anything, in his case, above all, because he doesn't actually exist. Observe, however, what happens when one moves just a little bit less far out on the continuum in either direction. I have been told, I suspect it isn't true, that in parts of Belarus, gangs prey so systematically on travellers on trains and buses that they've developed a habit of giving each victim a little token to confirm that the bearer has already been robbed. Obviously, one step towards the creation of a state. Actually, one popular theory of the origins of the state, that goes back to at least the 14th century North African historian Ibn Khaldun, runs precisely along these lines. Nomadic raiders eventually systematize their relations with sedentary villagers, pillage turns into tribute, rape into the right of the first night, or the carrying off of likely candidates as recruits for the royal harem. Conquest, untrammeled force, becomes systematized, and thus framed not as a predatory relation, but as a moral one, with lords providing protection and villagers their sustenance. But even if all parties assume they are operating by a shared moral code, that even kings cannot do whatever they want but must operate within limits, allowing peasants to argue about the rights and wrongs of just how much of their harvest a king's retainers are entitled to carry off, they are very unlikely to frame their calculation in terms of the quality and quantity of protection provided, but rather in terms of the custom and precedent. How much did we pay last year? How much did our ancestors have to pay? The same is true on the other side. If charitable donations become the basis for any sort of social relation, it will not be one based on reciprocity. If you give some coins to a panhandler, and that panhandler recognizes you later, it's unlikely that he'll give you any money, but he might well consider that you're more likely to give him money again. Certainly this is true if one donates money to a charitable organization. I gave money to the United Farm Workers once, and I still haven't heard the end of it. Such an act of one-sided generosity is treated as a precedent for what will be expected afterward. It's quite the same if one gives candy to a child. This is what I mean when I say that hierarchy operates by a principle that is the very opposite of reciprocity. Whenever the lines of superiority and inferiority are clearly drawn and accepted by all parties as the framework of a relationship, and relations are sufficiently ongoing that we're not simply dealing with arbitrary force, then relations will be seen as being regulated by a web of habit or custom. Sometimes the situation is assumed to have originated in some founding act of conquest, or it might have been seen as ancestral custom for which there is no need of explanation. But this introduces another complication to the problem of giving gifts to kings, or to any superior. There is always the danger that it will be treated as a precedent, added to the web of custom, and therefore considered obligatory thereafter. Xenophon claims that in the early days of the Persian Empire, each province vied to send the great king gifts of its most unique and valuable products. This eventually became the basis of the tribute system. Each province was eventually expected to provide the same gifts every year. Similarly, according to the great medieval historian Mark Bloch, quote, in the 9th century, when one day there was a shortage of wine in the royal cellars at Ver, the monks of Saint-Denis were asked to supply the 200 hogsheads required. This contribution was thenceforth claimed from them as of right every year, and it required an imperial charter to abolish it. At Ardres, we are told, there was once a bear, the property of a local lord. The inhabitants, who loved to watch it fight with the dogs, undertook to feed it. The beast eventually died, but the lord continued to exact the loaves of bread. Unquote. In other words, any gift to a feudal superior, especially if repeated 3 or 4 times, was likely to be treated as a precedent and added to the web of custom. As a result, those giving gifts to superiors often insisted on receiving a letter of non-prejudice legally stipulating that such a gift would not be required in the future. While it is unusual for matters to become quite so formalized, any social relation that is assumed from the start to be unequal will inevitably begin to operate on an analogous logic, if only because, once relations are seen as based on custom, the only way to demonstrate that one has a duty or obligation to do something is to show that one has done it before. Often, such arrangements can turn into a logic of caste. Certain clans are responsible for weaving the ceremonial garments, or bringing the fish to royal feasts, or cutting the king's hair. They thus come to be known as weavers or fishermen or barbers. This last point can't be overemphasized, because it brings home another truth regularly overlooked, that the logic of identity is, always and everywhere, entangled in the logic of hierarchy. It's only when certain people are placed above others, or where everyone is being ranked in relation to the king, or the high priest, or founding fathers, that one begins to speak of people bound by their essential nature, about fundamentally different kinds of human being. Ideologies of caste or race are just extreme examples. It happens whenever one group is seen as raising themselves above others, or placing themselves below others, in such a way that ordinary standards of fair dealing no longer apply. In fact, something like this happens in a small way even in our most intimate social relations. The moment we recognize someone as a different sort of person, either above or below us, then ordinary rules of reciprocity become modified or are set aside. If a friend is unusually generous once, we will likely wish to reciprocate. If she acts this way repeatedly, we conclude she is a generous person and are hence less likely to reciprocate. We can describe a simple formula here. A certain action, repeated, becomes customary. As a result, it comes to define the actor's essential nature. Alternately, a person's nature may be defined by how others have acted toward him in the past. To be an aristocrat is largely to insist that in the past others have treated you as an aristocrat. Since aristocrats don't really do anything in particular, mostly spend their time simply existing in some sort of putatively superior state, and therefore that you should continue to do so. Much of the art of being such a person is that of treating oneself in such a manner that it conveys how you expect others to treat you. In the case of actual kings, covering oneself with gold so as to suggest that others do likewise. On the other end of the scale, this is also how abuse becomes self-legitimating. As a former student of mine, Sarah Stillman, pointed out, in the United States, if a middle-class 13-year-old is kidnapped, raped, and killed, it's considered an agonizing national crisis that everyone with a television is expected to follow for several weeks. If a 13-year-old girl is turned out as a child prostitute, raped systematically for years, and ultimately killed, all this is considered unremarkable, really just the sort of thing that one can expect to end up happening to someone like that. When objects of material wealth pass back and forth between superiors and inferiors as gifts or payments, the key principle seems to be that the sort of things given on each side should be considered fundamentally different in quality, their relative value impossible to quantify, the result being that there is no way to even conceive of squaring accounts. Even if medieval writers insisted on imagining society as a hierarchy in which priests would pray for everyone, nobles fight for everyone, and peasants feed everyone, it never even occurred to anyone to establish how many prayers or how much military protection was equivalent to a ton of wheat. Nor did anyone ever consider making such a calculation. Neither is it that lowly sorts of people are necessarily given lowly sorts of things and vice versa. Sometimes it's quite the opposite. Until recently, just about any notable philosopher, artist, poet, or musician was required to find a wealthy patron for support. Famous works of poetry or philosophy are often prefaced, oddly to the modern eye, with gushing, sycophantic praise for the wisdom and virtue of some long-forgotten earl or count who provided a meagre stipend. The fact that the noble patron merely provided room and board, or money, and that the client showed his gratitude by painting the Mona Lisa, or composing the Toccata, or the fugue in D minor, was in no way seen to compromise the assumption of the noble's intrinsic superiority. There is one great exception to this principle, and that is the phenomenon of hierarchical redistribution. Here, though, rather than giving back and forth the same sorts of things, they give back and forth exactly the same thing, as, for instance, when fans of certain Nigerian pop stars throw money onto the stage during concerts, and the pop stars in question make occasional tours of their fans' neighborhoods tossing the same money from the windows of their limos. When this is all that's going on, we may speak of an absolutely minimal sort of hierarchy. In much of Papua New Guinea, social life centers on the big men, charismatic individuals who spend much of their life coaxing, cajoling, and manipulating in order to acquire masses of wealth to give away again at some great feast. One could, in practice, pass from here to, say, an Amazonian or indigenous North American chief. Unlike big men, their role is more formalized. But actually, such chiefs have no power to compel anyone to do anything they don't want to do. Hence, North American Indian chiefs' famous skill at oratory and powers of persuasion. As a result, they tended to give away far more than they'd received. Observers often remarked that in terms of personal possessions, a village chief was often the poorest man in the village. Such was the pressure on him for constant supply of largesse. Indeed, one could judge how egalitarian a society really was by exactly this, whether those ostensibly in positions of authority are merely conduits for redistribution, or able to use their positions to accumulate riches. The latter seems most likely in aristocratic societies that add another element, war and plunder. After all, just about anyone who comes into a very large amount of wealth will ultimately give at least part of it away, often in grandiose and spectacular ways to large numbers of people. The more of one's wealth is obtained by plunder or extortion, the more spectacular and self-aggrandizing will be the forms in which it's given away. And what's true of warrior aristocracies is all the more true of ancient states, where rulers almost invariably represented themselves as the protectors of the helpless, supporters of widows and orphans, and champions of the poor. The genealogy of the modern redistributive state, with its notorious tendency to foster identity politics, can be traced back not to any sort of primitive communism, but ultimately to violence and war. Shifting between modalities. I should underline here again that we're not talking about different types of society here, As we've seen, the very idea that we've ever been organized into discrete societies is dubious, but moral principles that always coexist everywhere. We're all communists with our closest friends and feudal lords when dealing with small children. It would be hard to imagine a society where people wouldn't be both. The obvious question is, if we are all ordinarily moving back and forth between completely different systems of moral accounting, why hasn't anyone noticed this? Why, instead, do we continually feel the need to reframe everything in terms of reciprocity? Here we must return to the fact that reciprocity is our main way of imagining justice. In particular, it's what we fall back on when we're thinking in the abstract, and especially when we're trying to create an idealized picture of society. I've already given examples of this sort of thing. Iroquois communities were based on an ethos that required everyone to be attentive to the needs of several different sorts of people. Their friends, their families, members of their matrilineal clans, even friendly strangers in situations of hardship. It was when they had to think about society in the abstract that they started to emphasize the two sides of the village, each of which had to bury the other's dead. It was a way of imagining communism through reciprocity. Similarly, feudalism was a notoriously messy and complicated business, but whenever medieval thinkers generalized about it, they reduced all its ranks and orders into some sort of simple formula in which each order contributed its share. Some fight, some pray, still others work. Even hierarchy was seen as ultimately reciprocal, despite this formula having nothing to do with the real relations between priests, knights, and peasants as they operated on the ground. Anthropologists are familiar with the phenomenon. It's only when people who have never had occasion to really think about their society or culture as a whole, who probably weren't even aware that they were living inside something other people consider as a society or a culture, are asked to explain how everything works, that they say things like, "This is how we repay our mothers for the pain of having raised us," or puzzle over conceptual diagrams in which Clan A gives their women in marriage to Clan B, who give theirs to Clan C, who give theirs back to A again, but which never seem to quite correspond to what real people actually do. When trying to imagine a just society, it's hard not to evoke images of balance and symmetry, of elegant geometries where everything balances out. The idea that there is something called the market is not so very different. Economists will often admit this if you ask them in the right way. Markets aren't real. They're mathematical models, created by imagining a self-contained world where everyone has exactly the same motivation and the same knowledge and is engaging in the same self-interested calculating exchange. Economists are aware that reality is always more complicated, but they are also aware that to come up with a mathematical model, one has to make the world into a bit of a cartoon. There's nothing wrong with this. The problem comes when it enables some, often these same economists, to declare that anyone who ignores the dictates of the market shall surely be punished, or that since we live in a market system, everything, except government interference, is based on principles of justice, that our economic system is just one vast network of reciprocal relations in which, in the end, the accounts balance and all debts are paid. These principles get tangled up in each other, and it's often difficult to tell which predominates in a given situation. One reason that it's ridiculous to pretend we could ever reduce human behavior, economic or otherwise, to a mathematical formula of any sort. Still, this means that some degree of reciprocity can be detected as potentially present in any situation, so a determined observer can always find some excuse to say it's there. What's more, certain principles appear to have an inherent tendency to slip into others. For instance, a lot of extremely hierarchical relationships can operate, at least some of the time, on communistic principles. If you have a rich patron, you come to him in times of need, and he is expected to help you, but only to a certain degree. No one expects the patron to provide so much help that it threatens undermining the underlying inequality. Likewise, communistic relations can easily start slipping into relations of hierarchical inequality, often without anyone noticing it. It's not hard to see why this happens. Sometimes different people's abilities and needs are grossly disproportionate. Genuinely egalitarian societies are keenly aware of this, and tend to develop elaborate safeguards around the dangers of anyone, say, especially good hunters in a hunting society,
rising too far above themselves, just as they tend to be suspicious of anything that might make one member of society feel in genuine debt to another. A member who draws attention to his own accomplishments will find himself the object of mockery. Often the only polite thing to do, if one has accomplished something significant, is to instead make fun of oneself. The Danish writer, Peter Freuchen, in his Book of the Eskimo, described how in Greenland one could tell what a fine delicacy someone had to offer his guests by how much he belittled it beforehand. Quote, "The old man laughed. 'Some people don't know much. I am such a poor hunter, and my wife a terrible cook who ruins everything. I don't have much, but I think there is a piece of meat outside. It might still be there, as the dogs have refused it several times.'" This was such a recommendation in the Eskimo way of backwards bragging that everyone's mouths began to water. Unquote. The reader will recall the walrus hunter of the last chapter, who took offence when the author tried to thank him for giving him a share of the meat. After all, humans help one another, and once we treat something as a gift, we turn into something less than human. Up here we see that by gifts one makes slaves, and by whips one makes dogs. A gift here does not mean something given freely, not mutual aid that we can ordinarily expect human beings to provide to one another. To thank someone suggests that he or she might not have acted that way, and that therefore the choice to act this way creates an obligation, a sense of debt, and hence inferiority. Communes or egalitarian collectives in the United States often face similar dilemmas, and they have to come up with their own safeguards against creeping hierarchy. It's not that the tendency for communism to slip into hierarchy is inevitable. Societies like the Inuit have managed to fend it off for thousands of years, but rather that one must always guard against it. In contrast, it's notoriously difficult, often downright impossible, to shift relations based on the assumption of communistic sharing to relations of equal exchange. We observe this all the time with friends. If someone is seen as taking advantage of your generosity, it's often much easier to break off relations entirely than to demand that they somehow pay you back. One extreme example is the Maori story about a notorious glutton who used to irritate the fishermen up and down the coast near where he lived by constantly asking for the best portions of their catch. Since to refuse a direct request for food was effectively impossible, they would dutifully turn it over, until one day people decided enough was enough and killed him. We've already seen how creating a ground of sociability among strangers can often require an elaborate process of testing the other's limits by helping oneself to their possessions. The same sort of thing can happen in peacemaking, or even in the creation of business partnerships. In Madagascar, people told me that two men who are thinking of going into business together will often become blood brothers. Blood brotherhood, fatidra, consists of an unlimited promise of mutual aid. Both parties solemnly swear that they will never refuse any request from the other. In reality, partners to such an agreement are usually fairly circumspect in what they actually request. But, my friends insisted, when people first make such an agreement, they sometimes like to test it out. One may demand the other's house, the shirt off his back, or, everyone's favourite example, the right to spend the night with his wife. The only limit is the knowledge that anything one can demand, the other can too. Here again, we are talking about an initial establishment of trust. Once the genuineness of the mutual commitment has been confirmed, the ground is prepared, as it were, and the two men can begin to buy and sell on consignment, advance funds, share profits, and otherwise trust that each will look after the other's commercial interests from then on. The most famous and dramatic moments, however, are those when relations of exchange threaten to break down into hierarchy. That is, when two parties are acting like equals, trading gifts or blows or commodities or anything else, but one of them does something that completely flips the scale. I've already mentioned the tendency of gift exchange to turn into games of one-upmanship, and how in some societies this potential is formalized in great public contests. This is typical, above all, of what are called heroic societies, those in which governments are weak or non-existent, and societies organized instead around warrior noblemen, each with his entourage of loyal retainers, and tied to the others by ever-shifting alliances and rivalries. Most epic poetry, from the Iliad to the Mahabharata to Beowulf, harkens back from this sort of world,
and anthropologists have discovered similar arrangements among the Maori of New Zealand and the Kwiakutl, Tlingit and Haida of the American Northwest coast. In heroic societies, the throwing of feasts and resulting contests of generosity are often spoken of as mere extensions of war, fighting with property or fighting with food. Those who throw such feasts often indulge in colourful speeches about how their enemies are thus crushed and destroyed by glorious feats of generosity aimed in their direction. Kwiakutl chiefs like to speak of themselves as great mountains from which gifts rolled like giant boulders, and of how conquered rivals are thus reduced, much as in the Inuit metaphor, to slaves. Such statements are not to be taken literally. Another feature of such societies is a highly developed art of boasting. Heroic chiefs and warriors tended to talk themselves up just as consistently as those in egalitarian societies talk themselves down. It's not as if someone who loses out in a contest of gift exchange is ever actually reduced to slavery, but he might end up feeling as if he were. And the consequences could be catastrophic. One ancient Greek source describes Celtic festivals, where rival nobles would alternate between jousts and contests of generosity, presenting their enemies with magnificent gold and silver treasures. Occasionally this could lead to a kind of checkmate. Someone would be faced with a present so magnificent that he could not possibly match it. In this case, the only honourable response was for him to cut his own throat, thus allowing his wealth to be distributed to his followers. 600 years later, we find a case from the Icelandic saga of an ageing Viking named Egil, who befriended a younger man named Einar, who was still actively raiding. They liked to sit together composing poetry. One day, Einar came by a magnificent shield, inscribed with old tales, and between the writing were overlaid spangles of gold with precious stones. No one had ever seen anything like it. He took it with him on a visit to Egil. Egil was not at home, so Einar waited 3 days, as was the custom, then hung the shield as a present in the mead hall, and rode off. Egil returned home, saw the shield, and asked who owned such a treasure. He was told that Einar had visited him, and given it to him. Then Egil said, "To hell with him! Does he think that I'm going to stay up all night and compose a poem about his shield? Get my horse! I'm going to have to ride after him and kill him." As Einar's luck would have it, he'd left early enough to put sufficient distance between himself and Egil. So Egil resigned himself to composing a poem about Einar's gift. Competitive gift exchange does not literally render anyone slaves. It is simply an affair of honour. These are people, however, for whom honour is everything. The main reason that being unable to pay a debt, especially a debt of honour, was such a crisis was because of how noblemen assembled their entourages. The law of hospitality in the ancient world, for instance, insisted that any traveller must be fed, given shelter, and treated as an honoured guest, but only for a certain length of time. If a guest did not go away, he would eventually become a mere subordinate. The role of such hangers-on has been largely neglected by students of human history. In many periods, from imperial Rome to medieval China, probably the most important relationships, at least in towns and cities, were those of patronage. Anyone rich and important would find himself surrounded by flunkies, sycophants, perpetual dinner guests, and other sorts of willing dependents. The drama and poetry of the time are full of such characters. Similarly, for much of human history, being respectable and middle class meant spending one's mornings going from door to door, paying one's respects to important local patrons. To this day, informal patronage systems still crop up, whenever relatively rich and powerful people feel the need to assemble networks of supporters, a practice well documented in many parts of the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and Latin America. Such relationships seem to consist of a slapdash mix of all three principles that I've been mapping out over the course of this chapter. Nevertheless, those observing them insist on trying to cast them in a language of exchange and debt. A final example. In a collection called Gifts and Spoils, published in 1971, we find a brief essay by the anthropologist Lorraine Blackster about a rural development in the French Polynese, most of whose inhabitants are farmers. everyone places a great emphasis on the importance of mutual aid. The local phrase means giving service, rendre service. People living in the same community should look out for one another and pitch in when the neighbours are having trouble. This is the essence of communal morality. In fact, it's how one knows that any sort of community exists. So far, so good. However, she notes, when someone does a particularly great favour, mutual aid can turn into something else. Quote, if a man in a factory went to the boss and asked for a job, and the boss found him one, this would be an example of someone giving service. The man who got the job could never repay the boss, but he could show him respect, or perhaps give him symbolic gifts of garden produce. If a gift demands a return, and no tangible return is possible, the repayment will be through support or esteem. Unquote. Thus does mutual aid slip into inequality. Thus do patron-client relations come into being. We've already observed this. I chose this particular passage because the author's phrasing is so weird. It completely contradicts itself. The boss does the man a favour. The man cannot repay the favour. Therefore, the man repays the favour by showing up at the boss's house with an occasional basket of tomatoes and showing him respect. So, which one is it? Can he repay the favour or not? Peter Freuchen's walrus hunter would, no doubt, think he knew exactly what was going on here. Bringing the basket of tomatoes was simply a way of saying thank you. It was a way of acknowledging that one owes a debt of gratitude, that gifts had in fact made slaves, just as whips make dogs. The boss and the employee are now fundamentally different sorts of people. The problem is that in all other respects they're not fundamentally different sorts of people. Most likely they're both middle-aged Frenchmen, fathers of families, citizens of the Republic, with similar tastes in music, sports and food. They ought to be equals. As a result, even the tomatoes, which are really a token of recognition of the existence of a debt that can never be repaid, has to be presented as if it was itself a kind of repayment, an interest payment on a loan that could, everyone agrees to pretend, someday be paid back, thus returning the two members to their proper equal status once again. It's telling that the favour is finding the client a job in a factory, because what happens is not very different from what happens when you get a job in a factory to begin with. A wage-labour contract is, ostensibly, a free contract between equals, but an agreement between equals in which both agree that once one of them punches the time clock, they won't be equals any more. The law does recognise a bit of a problem here. That's why it insists that you cannot sell off your equality permanently. You are not free to sell yourself into slavery. Such arrangements are only acceptable if the boss's power is not absolute, if it's limited to work time, and if you have the legal right to break off the contract, and thereby to restore yourself to full equality, at any time. It seems to me that this arrangement between equals to no longer be equal, at least for a time, is critically important. It's the very essence of what we call debt. What then is debt? Debt is a very specific thing, and it arises from very specific situations. It first requires a relationship between two people who do not consider each other fundamentally different sorts of being, who are at least potential equals, who are equals in those ways that are really important, and who are not currently in a state of equality, but for whom there is some way to set matters straight. In the case of gift-giving, as we've seen, this requires a certain equality of status. That's why our economics professor didn't feel any sense of obligation, any debt of honour, if taken out to dinner by someone who ranked either much higher or much lower than himself. With money loans, all that is required is that the two parties be of equal legal standing. You can't lend money to a child or to a lunatic. Well, you can, but the courts won't help you get it back. Legal, rather than moral, debts have other unique qualities. For instance, they can be forgiven, which isn't always possible with a moral debt. This means that there is no such thing as a genuinely unpayable debt. If there was no conceivable way to salvage the situation, we wouldn't be calling it a debt. Even the French villager could, conceivably, save his patron's life, or win the lottery and buy the factory. Even when we speak of a criminal paying his debt to society, we are saying that he's done something so terrible that is now being banished from that equal status under the law that belongs by natural right to any citizen of his country. However, we call it a debt because it can be paid. Equality can be restored, even if the cost may be death by lethal injection. During the time that the debt remains unpaid, the logic of hierarchy takes hold. There is no reciprocity. As anyone who's ever been in jail knows, the first thing the jailers communicate is that nothing that happens in jail has anything to do with justice. Similarly, debtor and creditor confront each other like a peasant before a feudal lord. The law of precedent takes hold. If you bring your creditor tomatoes from the garden, it never occurs to you that he would want to give something back. He might expect you to do it again, though. But always there is the assumption that the situation is somehow unnatural because the debt really ought to be paid. This is what makes situations of effectively unpayable debt so difficult and so painful. Since creditor and debtor are ultimately equals, if the debtor cannot do what it takes to restore herself to equality, there is obviously something wrong with her. It must be her fault. This connection becomes clear if we look at the etymology of common words for debt in European languages. Many are synonyms for fault, sin, or guilt. Just as a criminal owes a debt to society, a debtor is always a sort of criminal. In ancient Crete, according to Plutarch, it was the custom for those taking loans to pretend to snatch the money from the lender's purse. Why, he wondered. Probably so that, if they default, they could be charged with violence and punished all the more. This is why, in so many periods of history, insolvent debtors could be jailed, or even, as in early Republican Rome, executed. A debt, then, is just an exchange that hasn't been brought to completion. It follows that debt is strictly a creature of reciprocity and has little to do with other sorts of morality. Communism, with its needs and abilities, hierarchy, with its customs and qualities. True, if we were really determined, we could argue, as some do, that communism is just a condition of permanent mutual indebtedness, or that hierarchy is constructed out of unpayable debts. But isn't this just the same old story, starting from the assumption that all human interactions must be by definition forms of exchange, and then performing whatever mental somersaults are required to prove it? No, all human interactions are not forms of exchange. Only some are. Exchange encourages a particular way of conceiving human relations. This is because exchange implies equality, but it also implies separation. It's precisely when the money changes hands, when the debt is cancelled, that equality is restored, and both parties can walk away, having nothing further to do with each other. Debt is what happens in between, when these two parties cannot yet walk away from each other because they're not yet equal. But it is carried out in the shadow of eventual equality, because achieving that equality, however, destroys the very reason for having a relationship. Just about everything interesting happens in between. In fact, just about everything human happens in between. Even if this means that all such human relations bear with them at least a tiny element of criminality, guilt, or shame. For the Tiv women whom I mentioned earlier in the chapter, this wasn't much of a problem. By ensuring that everyone was always slightly in debt to one another, they actually created a human society, if a fragile sort of society, a deliberate web made up of obligations to return 3 eggs or a bag of okra, ties renewed and recreated, as any one of them could be cancelled out at any time. Our own habits of civility are not so very different. Consider the custom in American society of constantly saying please and thank you. To do so is often treated as basic morality. We are constantly chiding children for forgetting to do it, just as the moral guardians of our society, teachers and ministers, for instance, do to everybody else. We often assume that the habit is universal, but as the Inuit hunter made clear, it isn't. Like so many of our everyday courtesies, it's a kind of democratization of what was once a habit of feudal deference, the insistence on treating absolutely everyone the way that one used only to have to treat a lord or similar hierarchical superior. Perhaps this is not so in every case. Imagine we're on a crowded bus looking for a seat. A fellow passenger moves her bag aside to clear one, We smile or nod or make some other little gesture of acknowledgement, or perhaps we actually say thank you. Such a gesture is simply a recognition of common humanity. We're acknowledging that the woman whose bag had been blocking the seat is not a mere physical obstacle, but a human being, and that we feel a genuine gratitude towards someone we will likely never see again. None of this is generally true when one asks someone at the table to please pass the salt, or when the postman thanks you for signing a delivery. We think of these simultaneously as meaningless formalities and as the very moral basis of society. Their apparent unimportance can be measured by the fact that almost no one would refuse on principle to say please or thank you in just about any situation, even for those who might find it almost impossible to say I'm sorry or I apologize. In fact, the English please is short for if you please, if it pleases you to do this. It's the same in most European languages, French, s'il vous plaît, Spanish, por favor. Its literal meaning is, you are under no obligation to do this. Hand me the salt, not that I'm saying you have to. This isn't true. There is a social obligation, and it'd be almost impossible not to comply. But etiquette largely consists of the exchange of polite fictions. To use less polite language, lies. When you ask someone to pass the salt, you're also giving them an order. By attaching the word please, you're saying that it's not an order, but in fact it is. In English, thank you derives from think. It originally meant, I will remember what you did for me, which is usually not true either. But in other languages, the Portuguese obrigado is a good example. The standard term follows the form of the English much obliged. It actually does mean, I am in your debt. The French merci is even more graphic. It derives from mercy, as in begging for mercy. By saying it, you're symbolically placing yourself in your benefactor's power, since a debtor is, after all, a criminal. Saying you're welcome or it's nothing, French de rien, Spanish de nada, the latter has at least the advantage of being literally true. It's a way of reassuring the one to whom one has passed the salt that you're not actually inscribing a debt in your imaginary moral account book. So is saying, my pleasure. You're saying, no, actually it's a credit, not a debit. You did me a favour, because in asking me to pass the salt, you gave me the opportunity to do something I found rewarding in itself. Decoding the tacit calculus of debt. I owe you one. No, you don't owe me anything. Actually, if anything, it's me who owes it to you. As if inscribing and then scratching off so many infinitesimal entries in an endless ledger makes it easy to understand why this sort of thing is often viewed not as the quintessence of morality, but as the quintessence of middle-class morality. True, by now middle-class sensibilities dominate society, but there are still those who find the practice odd. Those at the very top of society often still feel that deference is owed primarily to hierarchical superiors, and find it slightly idiotic to watch postmen and pastry cooks taking turns pretending to treat each other like little feudal lords. At the other extreme, those who grew up in what in Europe are called popular environments, small towns, poor neighbourhoods, any place where there is still an assumption that people who are not enemies will, ordinarily, take care of one another, will often find it insulting to be constantly told, in effect, that there is some chance they might not do their job as a waiter or taxi driver correctly, or provide house guests with tea. In other words, middle-class etiquette insists that we are all equals, but it does so in a very particular way. On the one hand, it pretends that nobody is giving anybody orders. Think here of the burly security guard at the mall, who appears before someone walking in a restricted area and says, "Can I help you?" On the other, it treats every gesture of what I've been calling baseline communism as if it really were a form of exchange. As a result, like in TIV neighbourhoods, middle-class society has to be endlessly recreated as a kind of constant flickering game of shadows, a criss-crossing of an infinity of momentary debt relations, each one almost instantly cancelled out. All of this is a relatively recent innovation. The habit of always saying please and thank you first began to take hold during the commercial revolution of the 16th and 17th centuries, among those very middle classes who were largely responsible for it. It is the language of bureaus, shops, and offices, and over the course of the last 500 years, it has spread across the world along with them. It is also merely one token of a much larger philosophy, a set of assumptions of what humans are and what they owe to one another, that have by now become so deeply ingrained that we can't see them. Sometimes, at the very brink of a new historical era, some prescient soul can see the full implications of what is beginning to happen, sometimes in a way that later generations can't. Let me end with a text by such a person. In Paris, sometime in the 1540s, François Rabelais, lapsed monk, doctor, legal scholar, composed what was to become a famous mock eulogy, which he inserted in the third book of his great Gargantua and Pantagruel, and which came to be known as In Praise of Debt. Rabelais places the encomium in the mouth of one Panurge, a wandering scholar and man of extreme classical erudition, who, he observes, knew 63 ways of making money, the most honourable and the most routine of which was stealing. The good-natured giant, Pantagruel, adopts Panurge and even provides him with a respectable income, but it bothers him that Panurge continues to spend money like water and remains up to his ears in debt. Wouldn't it be better, Pantagruel suggests, to be able to pay his creditors? Panurge responds with horror, God forbid that I should ever be out of debt. Debt is, in fact, the very basis of his philosophy. Quote, always owe somebody something. Then he will be forever praying God to grant you a good, long, and blessed life. Fearing to lose what you owe him, he will always be saying good things about you in every sort of company. He will be constantly acquiring new lenders for you, so that you can borrow to pay him back, filling his ditch with other men's spoil. Unquote. Above all else, they will always be praying that you come into money. It's like those ancient slaves destined to be sacrificed at their master's funerals. When they wished their master long life and good health, they genuinely meant it. What's more, debt can make you into a kind of god, who can make something, money, well-wishing creditors, out of absolutely nothing. Quote, worse still, I give myself to Bonnie St. Bobelin if all my life I have not reckoned debts to be, as they were, a connection and colligation between heaven and earth, uniquely preserving the lineage of man, without which, I say, all human beings would soon perish, and perhaps to be that great world soul which, according to the academics, gives life to all things. That it really is so, evoke tranquilly in your mind the idea and form of a world, take, if you like, the 30th of the worlds imagined by Metrodorus, in which there were no debtors or lenders at all, a universe sans dette. Amongst the heavenly bodies, there would be no regular course whatsoever. All would be in disarray. Jupiter, reckoning that he owed no debt to Saturn, would dispossess him of his sphere, and with his Homeric chain, hold in suspension all the intelligences, gods, heavens, demons, geniuses, heroes, devils, earth, sea, and all the elements. The moon would remain dark and bloody. Why should the sun share his light with her? He is under no obligation. The sun would never shine on the earth. The heavenly bodies would pour no good influences down upon it. Between the elements, there will be no mutual sharing of qualities, no alternation, no transmutation whatsoever. One will not think itself obliged to the other. It has lent it nothing. From earth no longer will water be made, nor water transmuted into air. From air fire will not be made, and fire will not warm the earth. Earth will bring forth nothing but monsters, titans, and giants. The rain will not rain. The light will shed no light. The wind will not blow. There will be no summer, no autumn. Lucifer will tear off his bonds, and sallying forth from the deepest hell with the Furies, the Vengeances, and the Horned Devils, will seek to turf the gods of both the greater and lesser nations out from their nests in the heavens. Unquote. And what's more, if human beings owed nothing to one another, life would be no better than a dogfight, a mere unruly brawl. Quote, amongst human beings, none will save another. It will be no good a man shouting, help, fire, I'm drowning, murder. Nobody will come and help him. Why? Because he's lent nothing, and no one owes him anything. No one has anything to lose by his fire, his shipwreck, his fall, or his death. He's lent nothing, and he would lend nothing either hereafter. In short, faith, hope, and charity would be banished from this world." Unquote. Panurge, a man without family, alone, whose entire calling in life was getting large amounts of money and then spending it, serves as a fitting prophet for the world that was just beginning to emerge. His perspective, of course, is that of a wealthy debtor, not one liable to be trundled off to some pestiferous dungeon for failure to pay. Still, what he is describing is the logical conclusion, the reductio ad absurdum, which Rabelais, as always, lays out with cheerful perversity, of the assumptions about the world as exchange, slumbering behind all our pleasant bourgeois formalities, which Rabelais himself incidentally detested. The book is basically a mixture of classical erudition and dirty jokes. And what he says is true. If we insist on defining all human interactions as matters of people giving one thing for another, then any ongoing human relations can only take the form of debts. Without them, no one would owe anything to anybody. A world without debt would revert to primordial chaos, a war of all against all. No one would feel the slightest responsibility for one another. The simple fact of being human would have no significance. We would all become isolated planets who couldn't even be counted on to maintain our proper orbits. Pantagruel will have nothing of it. His own feelings on the matter, he says, can be summed up with one line from the Apostle Paul. "Owe no man anything save mutual love and affection." Then, in an appropriately biblical gesture, he declares, "From your past debts I shall free you." "What can I do but thank you?" Panurge replies.